Hello and welcome to episode 29 of the Data Driven Strength Podcast. Today, myself and Zach will be discussing a few topics today. The first is a segment from Zach in which we'll discuss the length of a quote-unquote training unit. We'll also chat about practicing tapers, pros and cons of longer and shorter training units. Then I will go over a segment looking at some studies specifically looking at within subjects designs that can give us some clues in terms of how to best individualize training. Then, time permitting, we will go into some listener questions as well. Before I kick it over to Zach to start his segment here, if you are so kind to go ahead and leave us a 5-star rating on either iTunes or Spotify, that'd be much appreciated. And as always, you can check out the description of the podcast in order to see some of the stuff we offer if you're interested in kind of, you know, helping out what we do here at Data Driven Strength. So with that, Zach, I'll kick it over to you and let you start chatting about training units and optimal lengths of those.
Yeah. So I think this is something you and I have been kind of just chatting about from a practical perspective. You know, Josh and I will frequently chat about just our experiences from coaching and just like things we've learned, things we're trying, that kind of stuff. And I guess I'll kind of describe what a training unit is here on the front end, and then I'll kind of get into some details on, you know, how we maybe have slightly changed our approach a little bit on that recently. So just very simply, when we kind of think about individualization, the way that we think about it is you have this thing that we'll call a training unit. That is where you kind of design your training intervention. You assess how that training intervention went by the outcome of interest that we'll talk about in a second. And then you repeat that training unit with further modifications in order to observe how the outcome of interest trends after that, you know, training unit has been completed. So the reason that's kind of open-ended is because you can really use a training unit in a variety of ways. You can take that all the way down to the session level, and you could complete the same session over and over again and kind of see how your outcome of interest changes. You can take that at the more the microcycle level, which is pretty popular nowadays. You can take it on more of the block level, where maybe you're repeating a 4-week chunk of training. And you can take it all the way up to like the training cycle level, where maybe it's a longer period of time, 8+ weeks, in which you're kind of repeating that training cycle over and over again and making modifications after that training unit has elapsed. So, you know, the way that we've usually viewed this problem is we've generally favored, a slightly longer approach. And that's for a variety of reasons we can kind of touch on a little bit here in a second. But I think now we've kind of maybe a little bit more made our approach a little bit more moderate. And that is because having both an excessively long and an excessively short training unit comes with some meaningful disadvantages in kind of our view of things. So to touch on kind of the very long kind of length of training units to start here, I think you can usually conceptualize that as probably like 12+ weeks. So like this is where your very old school periodization models will come in, where they have like a 4-year plan of training kind of written out that's relatively strict. There's still some flexibility within that, of course, of practitioners of those styles. But for the most part, it's relatively strict and detailed for very long periods of time. You could even consider this like a yearly plan for somebody who has like a, you know, I'm going to do 6 months of this, and then I'm going to do 3 months of this, 3 months of that. It's just those really long-term plans. And really the disadvantage in my mind that those very long training units seem to have is that it's going to rely on some pretty big assumptions for an individual. So just as a very basic example, if we take like the very standard periodization model of like a longer, you know, muscle endurance and or hypertrophy phase, then you go into like a strength phase, and then you might even transition that into like a power or a peaking phase. That basically makes the assumption that all of those effects are going to be perfectly captured for each individual, and that's going to potentiate the next style of training. Now, as we've discussed before, some of those assumptions may be better than others, but on the whole, you definitely are leaving some ground to miss the mark there, especially on the individual level, in which some athletes may need more dedicated training for one of those qualities than the other, and transitioning out of a certain phase may just completely miss the mark for that individual specifically. Now, switching to the other end of the spectrum, we are taking things maybe on that session or week level. there does probably come some disadvantages there in the sense that you're really relying on short-term trends to tell the entire story. Now, that's not to say either of these approaches can't work at all. That's not what we're saying. But it does somewhat dismiss some of these higher order effects that, just like we talked about, we can never really know if they're happening. But based on the evidence that we have, some of the observational evidence, and just basically our practical experience to some degree as well, in our minds, it seems to make sense in general to try to set up training that's going to capture some of those higher order effects, even if we can't 100% know that they actually are happening. And so what I mean by that is, you know, if we're looking at, you know, coming back to that outcome of interest in this example, let's say we're training a powerlifter for 1 RM strength. In that case, our outcome of interest is going to be the absolute load on the bar for their top sets or an estimated 1 RM of some kind. If we're having a pretty short training unit, we're basically only taking into account what's happening in the day-to-day or the week-to-week. And while that's going to be a really solid way of keeping a pulse on performance, that obviously isn't going to take into account what happened last block and how that has an effect on the current block of training. Meaning that we're just completely relying on kind of the short-term trends to tell us the entire story of what's going on. And so really all that we're trying to say there is that there's probably a middle ground that can somewhat rely on the reactive things that are happening in the present, on the magnitude of weeks or months, but also not be so short that we can still try to take into account some of these higher order effects that on average probably exist to some degree. And that's where I think you kind of get in that Goldilocks zone of somewhere between like a 6 to 12 week training unit on average. And I think somewhere in that, you know, 8 to 10 weeks is probably the sweet spot. But, you know, individual cases may vary there depending on the overall context. But I'll stop there. Josh, do you have any questions before I keep rolling here?
No, I don't think I have anything to add. I would just say, like, there are ways to do it kind of, you know, on either end of the spectrum that can work very, very well, right? Like you can kind of have like a training unit, but then understand that it, like a shorter training unit, but then understand that it might take time for that to manifest. And then you kind of basically end up doing the same thing that we're saying and ending up maybe in that 6 to 8 week range, right? So like, I would just be very clear that it's not a, you know, dichotomous choice, and there's ways to kind of make it work on both ends of the spectrum. Like I know a lot of individuals will do like 16 to 20 week cycles with like a bunch of 4 week waves, and like, yeah, I guess you're looking at the cycle as a whole, but you can also kind of look at each wave individually, right? And kind of like make observations at each time point. So this is kind of within the context of how we like to think of things and how we like to periodize things and incorporate the likelihood that second order effects are a thing. But, you know, there's many ways to kind of go about this that probably end up in a similar, you know, actual practical approach anyway.
Yeah, 100%. I think it also kind of, you know, part of this conversation is dependent on the definition of training unit, like we discussed. And I think you could have some degree of an argument to say like how much change is really changing the training unit, if that makes sense. Like in that example of like the 16 or 24 week training cycle in which you have multiple 4 week waves, if you're making very, very small modifications per each one of those waves, you know, you could kind of go back and forth whether that is, you know, evaluating a training unit of 4 weeks or is that an entire training cycle. It's, you know, like you said, it's really dependent on the overall context, but this is just kind of coming from our perspective, the way we like to program, the way we like to kind of define and think about things. So I think your point is extremely well taken, that there's definitely more than one way to go about this and be successful. And just because you know, maybe rely on a very short or a very long training unit doesn't mean you're completely ignoring some of the limitations that I discussed. Just like we say all the time, like every tool you're going to utilize here from a training perspective is going to have limitations. But being aware of those limitations can allow you to kind of develop an overall system and systematic process that can do your best to add additional tools that cover up those limitations of the thing you're doing. So ultimately, I completely agree with what you're saying. There may be advantages and disadvantages to each approach, but that doesn't not mean that you can't have other tools to help rectify some of those things in the overall way that you do things. Again, this is just coming from our perspective, the way we like to do things and the way that we conceptualize training. So I'll keep rolling basically on that. And I think really ultimately why I kind of have come down to like this 6 to 12 week and maybe that 8 week sweet spot being a good place for most people is I think it has a nice balance of what I just call mechanistic versus outcome-oriented decision-making. The very long training cycles are going to be, like we said, reliant upon a ton of like mechanistic theory. Hypertrophy potentiates strength. Strength potentiates peaking or power or whatever. And again, while those are probably going to be relatively safe assumptions on average, for an individual, you're making a ton of assumptions there. And the thing I always like to point out, like we've discussed a lot of those are based on research, which obviously we're a huge fan of using that to the most useful extent possible. But there are still, you know, massive limitations that happen on some of these bedrock foundational principles that kind of get extrapolated into areas that probably shouldn't be. And just like a very basic example of this is something we've been harping on a lot and something you're going to touch on, Josh, in a little bit. There is a massive difference between looking at the means or averages of a given training approach and how that trends versus the individual level changes. Like that potentiation of hypertrophy to strength to peaking or power probably is a safe assumption on the whole, but there could be wildly different individual differences depending on their strength limiter, kind of going back to last episode. I think that's kind of a nice way to tie all these things together. Depending on the strength quality that an individual lacks, those kind of mechanistic assumptions may be less granted for a specific person. Thus, we need to have some balance of outcome-oriented thinking to kind of bring us back to home base. And I think that's where these shorter kind of training cycles or training units, kind of shine, because you are really allowing that to take front and center of the stage, right? And so I think having some sort of outcome that you are tracking and basing your decision-making on primarily is definitely where you want to live, and then have some of those mechanistic assumptions of potentiation and all those kind of things maybe sitting in the background of something that you set up training in general to try to capture those for the vast majority. A very basic example of this is, on average, we'll set up some individual's training unit to have quite a bit of work that seems to be more productive for hypertrophy on average, and then kind of shift to some more strength focused training at the end of the training unit. But the actual composition of those phases is almost entirely dependent on the outcomes for that individual. A very basic example that I like to kind of come back to is when we talk about the low fatigue stuff. You know, as a quick synopsis of that, we believe on average, you know, the closer you get to a strength test, you should probably minimize the degree of intraset fatigue for your volume work to let the kind of top sets and the peak heavy exposures shine, because that seems to be the predominant factor to predict strength gains in the short to moderate term load. That's on average, right? And so like the actual X's and O's of that is going to be almost entirely dependent on the individual. We're going to have some people that maybe take that all the way to the largest extent. Maybe they're doing singles with 80 to 85% of 1RM for quite a few sets to really hammer home some of those concepts for their volume work. Whereas I have other individuals that are still doing sets of 5 to 6 at a 7 RPE, which, you know, on paper isn't exactly how you would expect that to look. But overall, the trend, maybe they're doing sets of 10 to a 9 to 10 RPE in their kind of hypertrophy dominant phase. And so that trend's pretty similar for most people. But the actual individual compositions of those is different. And so you can see how that's simultaneously directed by the outcomes of the individual, but also somewhat mechanistically influenced of what we think is going to be capturing those higher order effects on average. Okay. So that's kind of the basic discussion of training units and kind of how I think we've kind of shifted our approach over time to kind of come to that line of thinking. But the ultimate question this is kind of based off, we got a question from one of the listeners about setting up your training in a way that's going to allow you to test tapering styles a little bit more frequently. And so I think this is where this kind of approach can be really effective. So you can think about it this way. There's probably an advantage to testing tapering a little bit more frequently than maybe is traditionally done. If you have 2 meets a year, maybe only really taper those 2 times for those both of those meets. Obviously, we've talked about it before on the podcast, but tapering is something in our coaching experience is super individual. Some people need quite a bit of training stress all the way up in the meet to feel practice or just feel strong in general, whereas other individuals, you know, maybe need 3 or 4 weeks of a steady decay that's a little bit more standard within the research of a tapering style, and that's also dependent on the lift within an individual. So there's a ton of ground that needs to kind of be played with there. And I think if you're only practicing tapering two times a year for both those meets, you're leaving a lot of kind of guesswork for an individual. And again, that's going to be almost entirely mechanistically driven if we're not able to test the outcomes of those tapers very often. So if we kind of come to this more moderate length training unit and kind of plug a taper at each one of those, it doesn't have to lead to like a true max test, but even if you're going up to singles at 9.5 RPE, that's going to provide some very, very solid insight onto how you can make adjustments to the taper for an individual going forward. And so ultimately, that's where I think the advantage of this more moderate length training unit is, because we're going to be able to test those tapers a little bit more frequently, but not so frequently that we have to deal with some of the workload constraints that would come with testing tapering maybe every 4 weeks or so. Pretty consistently, you'll find not only if people kind of really go after the peak heavy exposure after that taper, maybe they take a single all the way to a 10 or maybe miss, then you kind of have that come down of the decreased training stress that you kind of have to slowly work your way back up. Now, it might not be a huge deal, but at least it's something to take into account. You kind of have to get the momentum ball rolling again before you can kind of enter quote unquote normal training for an individual. So I think there's kind of a balance there of how frequently you want to do it, making sure you're not doing it all the time, but also enough that you can actually gain some meaningful data for an individual and try to really dial in those tapers for each of the lift for an individual. I'll stop there, Josh. What do you else got to add?
Yeah, this reminds me of a paper from Pearson and colleagues from 2020. It just kind of comes to mind because the last webinar I did for our individualized programming group, I did it on attempt selection, and I kind of started that webinar setting it up by saying, like, let's first think about the goal of every single time you test. And sometimes the goal is not necessarily to like truly hit 100% of your capabilities on that day. Like, you can practice a taper, work up to like a single at 8-9 and you're good to go. You can kind of like train through, but you still get to kind of see how that taper played out and how it affected you. Right. But anyway, this study does have a good amount of limitations just on the way they kind of collected their data. But nonetheless, kind of my take home from the paper and the authors kind of presented this take home in the discussion, which I think is a really good practical recommendation, is somewhere around like four or five times per year you want to like test, right? So like, tapering is a skill that needs to be practiced, right? Like, tapering and testing, that's a skill that needs to be practiced. But we also want to make sure we have like enough time between those testing periods to improve, right? So this kind of can also set the stage in terms of thinking about the training unit, because if part of that training unit is actually practicing a taper, right, at the end of it, because practicing that is a skill and getting more training data on that to better individualize it for the lifter in front of you, again, we can kind of work backwards from that and say, okay, if it's somewhere around 4 to 5 times per year, that can kind of indicate, okay, you know, somewhere in that, you know, 10 to 12 week range might be a really good starting point for a training cycle. So I just kind of wanted to add that, you know, we can talk about the high level benefits of shorter and longer training units, but also when you think of just like a calendar year, right? You also want to think about, okay, how often do we want to practice a taper? We have, you know, this date on the calendar where that's where we want to be the absolute strongest in the year, right? Because you have a certain competition or something else, but we also want to practice it elsewhere, right? So anyway, that just kind of reminded me of that study. And I think that can, you know, also help make this decision within your own system.
Yeah, totally agree. Really, the last thing I have here is just a few of the psychological considerations of kind of setting up training. We do have one of the questions at the end of the podcast after Josh's kind of segment here that we might get to. It talks about this a little bit too, so I'm not going to go into too much depth. But I think another advantage of this is just we found recently that kind of using an approach that gets people to kind of look forward to a very peak exposure is something that not only gives people more practice for a tapered 1RM, practice the attempt selection process, practice, you know, doing all three lifts in a single session, like all those things that are, tangible benefits. I think it also just adds to that even more and can kind of, set people up for success for the entire training unit, not just that one week, if that makes sense. So one thing we've, noticed recently, I think at least I have in general, use an approach that kind of sustains a top set load for the most part. Maybe like an intro week, I'll go triple out of 6 to 7, then I'll go triple out of 7 to 8 on week 2, and then double out of 7 to 8, single out of 7 to 8, and then we might maintain that single to 7 to 8 for the rest of the training unit or the training block. I think there's a good amount of benefits to that, but I also think that there is an advantage from an adherence perspective to nailing those RPEs if we can kind of lay out a plan that works people up to like a very peak exposure. And so I've had a couple examples where I'll do this, where maybe I start a little bit lower RPE on a top set, but work people all the way up to like a triple out of 9 to 10 throughout the course of a block. And just the fact that, I'll write a little note in there on somebody's training that's coming, that kind of nails their expectations for the rest of the block and makes it so that they're really adherent to the RPE prescription for those top sets that maybe are a little bit less exciting and are easier for people to overshoot and not really see the kind of the vision of where we're going. And I think a taper just exponentially makes that even easier. If people know they're kind of waiting to some degree for this taper and this kind of testing session, while we don't want to put all of our eggs in the basket of how the training unit went for that individual session, because individualizing tapering is so important, as we've kind of discussed throughout this entire segment, I do think that just is a psychological tool to benefit some individuals even more so, to really understand the purpose of each week and just nail the execution of that to make sure they're setting themselves up for success for week after week. And I think for people who have a hard time kind of building momentum, knowing that that's coming, I just think is a huge tool to leverage in some instances. Now, I don't think that has to be everybody. There's some people that do better with that kind of sustained approach where they're, they can see very tangibly the goalposts aren't shifting week to week, and they like that to be able to measure up their progress directly. I just think that it's kind of a tool to have in your toolbox to be able to leverage that for certain people that maybe do a little bit better with that kind of larger scale plan in mind. Josh, I know this is something you've been playing around with a lot, so I don't know if you want to add anything there.
Yeah, I'm going to try to not be too prop this up too much, but hopefully the listener can tell we speak with probably too much caution most of the time. But like I genuinely mean it when I say that switching from kind of like a steadier approach to this more aggressive ramping approach that leads to kind of like a higher peak week or like a, that final week of the block where you just kind of let them loose. I genuinely mean that I've had multiple lifters that has like just kind of changed the trajectory of their training. Probably related to personality type and just the way they execute a given protocol and the way they approach training on a day-to-day basis. Like you said, if you can kind of have each week have a purpose, right? So something that I'll often do is just color code the weeks, right? This is either a green week, a yellow week, or a red week. Most weeks are going to be yellow weeks, right? Those are kind of your normal training weeks where you're training hard, but you're trying to minimize any significant overshoots. And you're keeping in mind that this is ultimately to set up that kind of peak exposure to come in a red week. I've found multiple benefits to that. A, it makes things more exciting for the lifter. They know what's to come. And it also kind of keeps them dialed in to know that something is on the horizon, right? And then in those red weeks, boom, let them loose. Like you said, triple at 9 to 10, depending on where you are in kind of a training cycle. And I've just found that to be a lot more exciting for a lot of lifters. And also for myself as a coach, I've found those weeks to be particularly helpful from like a data analysis perspective, right? Like I'm very confident that they probably crossed their T's and dotted their I's going into that session because they knew it was a big session. So this training data is going to be a little bit more reliable. Also, we have to rely on estimated 1RM a little bit less kind of that projection of estimated 1RM because it wasn't like a triple at 7.5, right? Which might be a little bit more susceptible to inaccuracy. So I've just found many benefits. Do I think it's going to be for everyone? No. Right now, I kind of think of it as like two archetypes of you know, patterns, right? So you have one that's a little bit more like wave loady, and that's a little bit more like ascending, and it leads to a higher peak. And then you have another one that you kind of stay a little bit more steady in terms of the training approach, and both in terms of the programming and the psychological approach, right? I also think you can split that up between different like days within a training week. So you could have your primary day be a little bit more ascending, be a little bit more aggressive towards the end of the block, secondary day, maybe a little bit more steady, right? Again, all of this is subject to kind of individual differences, personality types, all these different things. Also, life context is another thing you can go into, right? Like those weeks later in a block with that more aggressive approach might be a little bit longer. Those each training session, that might be unrealistic for some individuals, or just, you know, their overall stress levels and kind of week to week variability. It's just really hard to time up. So lots of considerations on an individual level, but I've just found that to be so helpful, both, you know, just athlete engagement, excitement to train, have something to look forward to. It's just something I've definitely learned the hard way. And you know, has made a significant difference in multiple lifters training that I work with.
Yeah. Literally the only thing I was going to add is like, I think you kind of touched on this, but something I would immediately see as a benefit as well is like, if you know something that's pretty darn challenging is coming up, you almost certainly to some degree are going to ratchet up your adherence to things outside of the gym as well, which I think if anything, we become increasingly more sympathetic to how much that matters. You know, auto regulation can do a ton of good things, and I think it decreases the margin of error of those things, but there's only so much you can make up for poor sleep, not nailing your protein intake and your nutrition, whether you're supposed to be in a, you know, surplus, deficit, maintenance, whatever, and just stress in general. I think having a training approach that kind of forces you to try to be adherent to those things as much as possible to get the outcome that you want when that really peak exposure week comes, I think is just another, you know, tangential benefit of setting things up that way. But yeah, we've been hammering on that for a while, Josh, unless you have anything to add, I'll kind of read you into the next segment here. Cool. So one thing, you know, we found, you know, increasingly more interesting, as we've kind of thought and about the research that we have on individualization more and more, is just, you know, within subjects design are going to provide a ton of interesting comparisons here to kind of give us a peek into the window of what we can know from like a training prescription perspective on individual differences and ultimately what is underlying those differences to the best we can with the data we have available. I recently did a webinar on some of this research on called Individualization Research Deep Dive for our individualized programming webinars, which, you know, I found really interesting, and Josh is going to kind of go into some of the within subject design studies that we have access to and kind of pull back the hood on the way that they design training and some of the things we can know from the individual differences observed.
Yeah, man. So like you said, I think this research is super relevant to all lifters and all coaches. And from a high level, like, this stuff is really exciting. I think I speak for both of us here. This is really exciting to us because this is kind of like why we got into this in the first place, right? Like, why is it that lifter A will scratch and claw to add 2.5 kilos to a lift, whereas lifter B walks through the gym and gets stronger, right? Like, obviously there's going to be some controllable factors that are going to influence things, but to what degree can we kind of level that response, right? And kind of, you know, determine how to set up training in order to maximize the outcomes for each individual. And that's ultimately what kind of drives us, because it's very, very clear that no single training approach is going to be perfect for every single individual, right? I don't think we need to do much convincing there. So to kind of set up these four studies I'm going to go into, like, if we think of hypertrophy, right, and I think strength, we can kind of conflate this with strength a little bit with a little bit more caution, but nonetheless, I think hypertrophy is a little bit easier to conceptualize here. It's going to be the result of quote-unquote external variables, so things like your training and your nutrition that ultimately kind of stimulate quote unquote internal variables. So in the case of hypertrophy, if we just, you know, say that mechanical tension is the driver there, even though there's more nuance there, that's ultimately going to stimulate mechanical tension and the subsequent response to that and ultimately lead to increased muscle size, right? And kind of the question is like, which matters more, right? Like, is this individual destined to always be a low responder? Or is there a way so that kind of those external variables can be set up in order to get them a better training response? And kind of those internal variables are ratcheted up, if you will, right? So I think, you know, the best way to answer this question is what's called a within subjects design. So for example, if Zach is a research subject, I would put one of his legs on a certain training protocol and his other leg on another training protocol. And what that does is it basically controls for a lot of things that typically aren't controlled for as well, right? So obviously Zach is one person. So like his nutrition is theoretically accounted for. His sleep is theoretically accounted for. His nutrition timing is more or less controlled for. And also most importantly, his genetics and kind of his inherent response to training is accounted for. So I'm going to go through four studies that all use this within subjects design that have different training programs in each leg. So the first I want to go through are two studies that were actually from the same data collection. So we can kind of think of them as one study, although they are two separate papers, and we'll link them in the description here. But importantly, with these studies, they didn't really vary the dose between the two legs. So when I say dose of training, that's just kind of like a high-level term for the amount of work done on each leg, okay? So the first paper is, the lead author is Damas, and that's from 2019. This used trained men, and each leg either did what they called controlled training or variable training. For controlled training, they did four sets of 9 to 12 reps to failure with 2 minutes rest between sets in both the leg press and the leg extension. Okay, and that's in each session. And then the other leg did variable training. So what they did with the variable training is they basically tried to make it like more or less like every single time you go in the gym, you're kind of doing something different type of thing. So they had four different training session types that they kind of like rotated through in like a kind of randomized order, but they made sure they did each of these sessions twice. So the first is they modulated load to four sets of 25 to 30. Right. So lower load, higher rep day. One of the other sessions was a higher volume day. So six sets of 9 to 12. And then the other day was a difference in contraction type. So they did four sets of 10 with supramaximal eccentrics. And then the last training session type was longer rest periods. Okay. So remember that I said that in this data collection, so both these papers I'm going to go over here, they didn't really vary the dose. As you can tell, like most of those training sessions were very similar to that four sets of 9 to 12 they were doing in the quote unquote controlled training, with the exception of that higher volume day where they did six sets on each leg press and leg extension. So luckily, they actually reported the total training volume in the study. It was, and due to that higher volume session type, in the variable training group, total training volume was actually slightly higher in the variable training. And this was a significant difference, but the magnitude of effect was quite small. So it was like a 12 or 13% difference in total training volume between the two legs. Zach, you got something to throw in?
The only thing I was going to add is like, I would say even probably the bigger contributor to that is probably the higher repetition session, which we know for muscle growth, the volume load probably isn't the best predictor for muscle growth. So I think that is another thing to take into account is like when we talk about dose, which you've already said, it's like it's something we can't totally quantify and something we've talked about a few times. But, you know, volume load's probably the closest thing we can have at the moment. But I would say the volume load is probably artificially elevated in that condition even more so because of that group training with the very high repetitions. We know from other studies that higher or lower load, higher repetition conditions blow normal training out of the water in terms of volume load. So that's just like another consideration, just to come back to your point even more so, that while total training volume load is probably a little bit different, I think that that higher repetition day probably exponentially increased that even more so than the higher set day.
Yeah, that's a great point. So basically, for the listener, to kind of put a bow on this study design, what you can kind of take home is that like the total training dose between the two legs within each individual was pretty dang similar, right? And when you look at the actual results from this study, so what the authors kind of said was a quote unquote like meaningful difference between legs. So like if we go back to the example of Zach as a training study, if one of his legs grew more than two typical errors of measurement than the other leg, they would say that was like, hey, one of your legs grew more than the other, right? And if you look at the outcomes from the study, none of the subjects benefited from one of the training approaches, right? So that controlled training compared to the other approach, the variable training, right? So basically the take home here is that when you have a relatively similar dose of training, the within individual responses are going to be very consistent. And if you click on the link in the description and pull up these papers, and you can look at the within individual response charts, right? So like you'll basically have a line connecting like each individual's leg. And if it's like really sloped in one direction, that would kind of indicate that one leg grew significantly more than the other. But you can see that just subjectively looking at this graph, like the within individual responses were very consistent, right? So just again, subjectively, and also based on their statistical approach, you know, when you have a similar training dose, the growth is going to be similar within an individual. Okay. The next paper, which again is from the same data collection as that study I just went over, so the training protocol is the exact same. This one is from Angleri, is the lead author, from 2021. They just looked at hypertrophy responses at the fiber level as opposed to the whole muscle level. And it kind of just confirmed the outcomes I just talked about. And this paper, the one that came out in 2021, was, and I'm just going to read the entire title here so you can get the full effect, is that they called it resistance training variable manipulations are less relevant than intrinsic biology in affecting muscle fiber hypertrophy, right? So if you just kind of take a step back and internalize that, basically what that suggests is that, hey, it's all about kind of that intrinsic response. It's not necessarily like you can get a better response if you have a better training approach for you, which I would take a little bit of issue with just based on that title. To be fair, I think if you read the discussion, it's very well written, and I think their conclusions were totally fair. But nonetheless, I think that title can catch some eyes and maybe be a little bit misleading, especially when you think about a couple of other studies that actually did vary the training dose. Okay, so I have two of them to go over here. Again, same thing as those other studies within subjects design. The first one is another study from Damas, also from 2019, but a different paper. This used untrained subjects, and they did three sets of about 10 reps to failure on leg extensions. One leg either trained 2 to 3 times per week, and the other leg trained 5 times per week. So basically, we have one leg that was either 6 or 9 sets per week, and the other leg is 15 sets per week. So a meaningful difference in training dose, right? So much different volume than the studies we just went over. That's like double or more than double in some cases, right? And what we see here with the same criteria for a meaningful difference, again, greater than 2 times the typical error of measurement, we saw that 7 subjects saw greater growth in the low volume leg, 6 saw greater growth in the high volume leg, and 6 saw similar growth, right? So what we see here is a way more variable response within subjects. And again, you can look at graphs similar to the ones I alluded to before, and you can see that they're way more sloped. Those lines, those within subject lines, are way less flat. And it's just like pretty eye-opening to kind of compare those two studies. Again, one that didn't vary dose and one that did vary dose, and how that influences the within subject's response, right? I think another interesting note is that they kind of reported that 3 subjects were quote-unquote non-responders in one leg, but only 1 subject was a non-responder in both legs. So in other words, 2/3 of the subjects that didn't respond to a certain training program did respond to a different training program, right? So again, I think this is a pretty cool proof of concept that you can take someone that isn't responding, adjust their training program by modulating the dose, and potentially see the outcome you're looking for. Zach, you got something to kind of chime in?
I can't remember. Do you recall if the two subjects that, three subjects that did kind of rescue their response, do you recall if they mentioned if that was in the higher volume condition and in most of those cases, if not all? I can't remember.
I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I think you can kind of answer that question. Like, you can kind of look at that question through a slightly different lens if you just look at like how many responded better to low volume and how many responded to high volume. But I think I see what you're saying, that like, hey, are non-responders more likely to respond better to high volume? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure off the top of my head. That'd be something good to circle back to. Okay. So this discussion so far has been primarily around hypertrophy outcomes, right? But in this DAMAS study, they also took 1RM strength gains. And if we look at those individual responses, five of the subjects saw greater 1 rep max strength gains from the high volume approach. Three saw greater strength gains for the low volume approach, and 11 saw similar responses between the two. So again, we kind of see this proof of concept for both hypertrophy and strength that some individuals are going to respond better to a different dose of training. Okay. One quick note there, you might be like, oh, that's interesting that there were more individuals that didn't see a different response between the two training programs for strength compared to hypertrophy. That's probably due to the typical error of measurement being greater for strength than for hypertrophy. So the typical error of measurement for 1RM strength was 3.64% that they used. For hypertrophy, it was 1.38%. So again, I wouldn't necessarily take that to say that like, oh, individualization is more important for hypertrophy. I just think there's a little bit of a logistical consideration there in terms of their stats. Yeah, go for it, Zach.
Just pulled up the graph just because I was curious. It looks like it kind of goes in both directions. One subject was again, this is just going off the graph. I haven't had time to comb through this perfectly, but just looking at the data points here, one subject did was a non-responder to lower frequencies and did lower frequencies and lower volumes and did considerably better with the higher frequency, higher volume. But then another subject was a non-responder to the higher frequency, higher volume, and did better with the lower frequency, lower volume. And that's the case for both muscle size and muscle strength. So pretty interesting. I would, that's kind of goes counter to the kind of endurance research, to my knowledge, that yep. In general, if you're a non-responder, if you perform higher training volumes, that could rescue that effect. This seems to suggest that training dose is very specific to some degree, meaning kind of got to nail it to see that response for some people. So interesting.
Yeah, I think also the next study I'm going to go over from Scarparelli in 2020, there's kind of the proof of concept there as well that, if someone's not responding, I think the evidence-based kind of mantra is like, oh, if they're not responding, bump them up in training volume. That might be a potential solution, but like also it looks like it might happen the other way. And also there's benefits to kind of taking a lower volume approach because it's a heck of a lot easier to accidentally underdose and work up from there as opposed to the other way around. But anyway, hopefully you can tell by going through this DAMAS paper from 2019, which again is different from that original 2019 DAMAS paper. Okay, now we're modulating the dose within subjects between legs, and now we see a pretty robust difference in response between legs in some individuals, right? And I think that's pretty cool, right? I think that's pretty cool that we have some control here, right? And I think that sets up a lot of interesting research. The last study I will go over, I'll probably go through this one a little bit more briefly just because I think the methods of this paper were awesome. However, they kind of inherently make them harder to describe and also like a little bit more difficult to make like broad sweeping claims. So hopefully you can kind of tell what I mean when I go through this. So again, this is from Scarparelli and colleagues from 2020. They used trained men here, and they split each individual's leg into either a They split one leg into a standardized approach in which they did 22 sets per week on the quadriceps. And then the other leg, they did a 20% increase on their quad training volume that they were doing before the study. So they kind of used their previous training logs and bumped it up by 20%. And they trained the leg press and the leg extension unilaterally. Okay. So if we look at the outcomes there, 10 saw better growth from the plus 20% approach. 5 saw better growth from the standardized 22 set per week approach. And 4 saw no difference. Again, considerably different outcomes compared to those original two papers I discussed in which dose wasn't modulated. Okay, now we're modulating dose. We see that only 4 of the 19 subjects didn't see a difference. Okay, now, as you can hopefully tell from the methods, there's an interesting confounder here is that you're also taking into consideration the changes in volume, right? So like we have this training dose, which we're saying is probably important to individualize based on these studies, but you also have this variable of the change in volume. So for like the standardized volume group, or the standardized volume condition, I should say, for some people, that was a really big decrease in volume. For some, it was a massive increase for others, right? So like up to 120% increase in training volume for some people to do 22 sets per week, right? So like, again, this one is a little bit harder to make, you know, overarching claims, but I think this study design is so cool and it's just such a cool paper to see how this leads to differential responses within an individual. So the take home after going through these three studies, 4 papers, is that based on what we have right now, and to be clear, this isn't a very big body of research, so I want to be very preliminary in these conclusions. What we can tell so far is that we at least have the proof of concept that varying the training dose within an individual can lead to different responses in strength and hypertrophy. So what that means is this is a pretty clear training variable to try to individualize, right? So I'll pause there. Zach, you got anything to add before I kind of go through some practical takeaways?
No, man, I don't think I do. I think you did a great job kind of summarizing this. This is, as Josh said, we only have a few studies on this, but it's the methods of these studies are extremely well done to be able to give us some of those takeaways that we can kind of immediately implement into practice. Like that's, you know, we just talked about why, you know, mean data is so limited in kind of the application to a given lifter. But this data is kind of the opposite. It's very practical in the sense that, okay, we can very clearly see for these individuals, which of course isn't the same as you, but this can happen. And so immediately that makes you take notice in the way that you prescribe and obviously systemize training, that you need to take this into account in the way that you individualize. And the kind of opposite of that is those original studies that you mentioned that don't seem to modify dose, but do have some different configurations of things, do kind of lend some credence to the fact that this dose concept may be something we really need to pay attention to as kind of one of the primary factors to individualize, given, you know, this is a limited body of research and we still need some other things to be kind of explored thoroughly before we can make that a very confident claim. But based on what we have now, I think this is something we definitely need to pay attention into, and from an individualization perspective is one of the only tangible things we can say with a semi, you know, meaningful degree of confidence that we should definitely try to take into account.
Yeah, well said. I think, again, there's proof of concept here in the research that training dose is a variable here. I think anecdotally and also just physiologically, it makes sense that this would be a very important variable to individualize, but absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence in the sense that there could be a ton of other variables that have a more robust effect on this within individual response. So there's still a lot to learn about what we like to call the configuration of the training dose, right? So like, again, this kind of like quote unquote training dose term we're using is like, yeah, it's like kind of training volume, but there's other factors that go into it. So it's hard to quantify, but you know, you can have like 10 units, 10 arbitrary units of training dose set up in one way, right? If we think about powerlifting, that can be a certain top set approach and a certain back off approach, right? Then you can also have 10 units of training dose with a different top set approach and back off approach, or maybe no top sets, right? So we still have a lot to learn about the configuration of the training dose. And I think that in practice, that's something we also like to focus on a lot. And anecdotally, it seems to make a difference. We just don't have the research there yet.
The final piece of practical implementation I'll say that I do think is something else we always like to highlight is while individualization is extremely important, and this dose factor does seem to be at least the primary thing we should be concerned with at the moment, I do think the kind of more high responders are going to be high responders kind of thing does lead some credence to the fact that there are more than one way to get positive outcomes for an individual. Now, coming back to that Damas study, that would suggest otherwise. But the point being is for the approach that saw better responses for a given person, there's probably a range around that. It's not going to be something that there's only absolutely one way to maximize outcomes for a given person. It's just that kind of getting this dose in the right spot seems to be an important factor, to which the next question is how wide can we vary the configuration before that starts to really impact the response as well? Just like the example Josh gave, maybe we have 10 units of arbitrary training dose in two scenarios. One instance, the load is considerably higher and the rest of the factors are kind of manipulated to make sure it's still 10 arbitrary units. Whereas the other example, maybe the average load is considerably less. And again, the rest of the factors are configured to make sure it's 10 arbitrary units. How wide of differences can we get in that factor and still see kind of the manifestation of the training dose still emerge? I guess is the question we just don't have an answer to. But the first couple studies we went over, I do think that somewhat lends credence to the fact that there's not just one training program for an individual. It's probably not a magic bullet. It's probably more of a magic range, if I had to guess.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's not like you have some, you know, if you were able to quantify this dose concept, like it's not like you have a specific number you need to go after, right? It's probably going to be a range. And I think another important thing to point out when we start to think about the configuration of that training dose, if I configure a training dose a certain way, that might have differential effects on the actual training dose between individuals. So in other words, based on the psychological approach that someone takes to a certain set or their absolute strength, right? Maybe you're taking a higher peak intensity approach and you have someone that's a really strong squatter and experiences whatever high anxiety going into a set like that. That might actually kind of manifest into a different dose than the individual that doesn't have those factors. So it gets complicated in practice, but I think, again, this dose thing is kind of a starting point, and then you can work backwards from there. And then just to kind of, you know, put a bow on this, and then we can move on to a listener question is like, I think to some degree, like, yes, high responders are going to be high responders. Even if you look at the, like, within subjects graph from the Damas study that did modulate dose, like, I think just in general, yeah, you see that some people, you know, they're going to respond really well in both legs. And that's just kind of the way it goes. And I think there's probably some degree of truth to that paper title I said, in that resistance training variable manipulations are less relevant than intrinsic biology in affecting muscle fiber hypertrophy. Like, there's probably some degree of truth to that. However, what's the alternative, right? And like, at the end of the day, we have the proof of concept. You can take a non-responder and make them a responder by modulating their training dose. What's the alternative? Is the alternative to not train? Like, I don't think anyone listening to this podcast is going to go that route. So, you know, there's hope. And I think, you know, in terms of finding a way to get those people that, you know, again, can't walk through the gym and just get stronger, finding a way to design their training for them is ultimately, you know, kind of what we're really interested in personally, and kind of what got us into this. So cool, man. Zach, do you want to ask or answer this question to start off from Drew?
I can give a shot to answer it first, just kind of going, like I said, off a little bit of what I described with my first segment here. So if you want to read me in, that'll be great.
Perfect. So this is pretty long, so I'll try to kind of condense this. And Drew, if you're listening, man, I apologize. I'm pretty sure you asked this like multiple months ago. It's a really good question. We've had it lined up here on the podcast for multiple episodes, but we haven't gotten to it. So I hope you're listening, and I hope this is a decent response a few months later. So basically he asks, hey, I've kind of circulated this question among other people kind of in the strength and conditioning space. And he's noticed that there hasn't been kind of a good answer, if you will, or like maybe not a good answer, but a consensus or something that everyone agrees on. And it's basically related to the difference between progressive overload and RPE progressions. So he said, traditionally, you'll see programs do something like 3 sets of 5 each week, but then in week 1, maybe it's RP 7, week 8, week 2, it's RP 8, week 3, it's RP 9, right? So an increase in RP week to week. He's like, and basically he says like, this seems off to me, right? Starting someone below their current capabilities and then increasing to the level of like overperformance or like beyond what they can actually recover from in the later weeks. He said his approach is to keep people constant at like, you know, maybe the middle point of that. So 3 sets of 5 at RP8 and then adjust once they plateau. And his question is, how do we adjust that stimulus to push past the plateau? Is it a simple change in RP at that point, an adjustment in reps? So basically it's like, how do you kind of conceptualize an increase in RP week to week and how that can inform troubleshooting and potentially the pros and cons versus that ascending RP approach versus a more steady approach?
Yeah, I think the first thing here is to apologize to Mr. Drew. I don't know if we're going to have a consensus here either. It's a great question, and I think it's something we'll continue to think on. But I guess to me, you know, I always take this from a higher level approach before we get to kind of the practical implementation of this. But I think there's a few assumptions probably is not the right word, but that's what the one I'm going to use, that this kind of question makes that I think are important to kind of tease out. So basically the overarching question from a practical perspective is, okay, we try to keep the stimulus constant, observe the response from said stimulus, and then make adjustments to the stimulus in order to continue to see the response go in the direction that we want. So the underlying assumption there is that we are able to appropriately quantify to some degree, it doesn't actually have to be numbers, but in like this higher level conceptual sense, the stimulus. And I just don't know if we can do that. I think that's ultimately the hang up for me, is that I don't know if we can say that the training intervention that we are doing currently is the only input into that equation to ultimately observe the output of the response and the outcome of interest. That's the crux of this that makes it so difficult to answer. Again, from our perspective, you got a lot of things that go into that performance. On a day-to-day level, you're going to have sleep, nutrition, fatigue, psychological approach, all of those things. Those are pretty obvious. That's why we use RP to account for some of those things. But that's still going to have some noise in the measurement on a week-to-week basis to know if whatever you're doing is working. Then you start layering on other things. You know, you get the second order effects of training to say, is the stimulus that preceded the training you're doing right now, is that what needs to change? Like, is the training you're doing right now actually not resulting in progress, or is it some combination of previous training that's influencing that as well? Ultimately, I just think there's a ton of arrows and ton of sources that go into that ultimate stimulus bucket that results in the ultimate observation of progression. That just makes it really difficult to have a concrete answer to say, this is what you should do when progression is no longer being observed, you know, on that week-to-week basis. And I think that's coming back to the original question we talked about, training units. I think that's one of the reasons that having a very short training unit is so difficult, because there are all of these factors that, just like, you know, in a study, we want to try to increase our sample size as much as we can to increase the confidence of our observations. If we draw out that training unit to be a little bit longer when we're evaluating progress, we'll have more data points to say conclusively whether what we're doing right now is no longer resulting in progress or not. And so that's what it makes it difficult to me to say, if I do three sets of five at RPE 8, I keep doing that every week or every session until I see a plateau in my performance. You know, maybe you do that for, see a plateau for 2 or 3 weeks, and then I make a change. I think that's a totally reasonable way to go about it from a practical perspective, but from a higher level philosophical perspective, there's so many things that go into that observation that I have a hard time saying there's a very systematic way of doing it. And so this is where you start getting the context of how is the individual feeling? How are they recovering? What is their perceived strength limiter? All of those things we've discussed in multiple podcasts. So I think, you know, if I had to come with an answer, I think you're really just going to come back to that first question. You have a training unit that you think is a reasonable time frame to make an observation to actually assess progress, capturing both of these mechanistic kind of potentiating effects of the higher order effects. And then you also have outcome-driven decision-making kind of like in the here and now. And then once you observe training progression to stall over that slightly longer time frame, taking into account both of those things, you do make a change, but the exact change is going to be entirely context dependent on the individual, their environment, and how that has changed over the course of the training unit. Maybe they got a new job, and that's going to reflect whether you add reps or decrease reps or whatever the case may be. It just kind of comes back to that concept of training dose we just touched on. To me, you run a training unit, you observe progress over that slightly longer interval, you assess whether progress is heading in the direction you want, and then you assess what you need to do with training dose based on the individual's environmental context from there, and then you just observe the response and tweak as you go. Ultimately, this is going to be primarily driven by kind of this trial and error process, and I don't think there's ever going to be this clear-cut way of adjusting training because it just is so dependent on the individual and their context, meaning it's just never going to be like this formulaic thing where you hit a plateau, you add volume, hit a plateau, you add volume. It's just going to be something that's just really context-dependent in my experience. So Josh, I don't know if I missed the mark there or anything you want to clean up, but that's kind of my perspective on this. But Drew, great question. It's something I'll definitely continue to think about for sure.
Yeah, just super quick. Like, I want to make sure the listener doesn't kind of, you know, misinterpret what you're trying to say. Like, you were like, hey, like a shorter training unit makes it difficult to kind of like assess what's going on. Like, I think it's important to say that, like, the training unit, like you can do it both ways, to be very clear. There are ways to kind of like account for the limitations of both approaches. Like, I just want to be clear that when you say it's difficult to keep the training like the training constant week to week, like, again, that's not to say that if you do go with a shorter training approach, that's you're not accounting for that or aware of those limitations. I just want to be very clear that that's not what you're saying.
Yeah, no, 100%. Sorry if that came across. It's definitely not what I'm saying. I think when we've talked about this before, I think it's ultimately just comes down to where you draw the line in the sand. I don't think either answer is correct. It just comes down to which assumption are you more comfortable with ultimately is what happens. If you want to take thing on a slightly shorter training unit and you make the assumption that, you know, some of those higher order effects are a little bit more difficult to account for versus a very long approach where you're not really taking the here and now outcomes into account as much. Both of those have limitations, but it's just a matter of weighing those limitations and seeing which one, you know, you're more comfortable with. And I think we're partially taking the enlightened moderate fallacy to some degree of just like sitting in the middle. It's like, yeah, we understand both these and we're going to sit somewhere in the middle. And I think there's definitely limitations to the way that we view this as well. And that's something that needs to be abundantly clear. I guess what I'm more so trying to say is that we're all guessing. We can't quantify the stimulus and ultimately we can't make an algorithm for where training needs to be adjusted perfectly in every single context for every single individual. That's basically what I'm trying to say, is that there's assumptions that go into that kind of stimulus calculation that need to account for more factors than just the training you're doing in the here and now, which makes understanding that modification very difficult. The advantage that I'll say, and I'll try to hammer this home, that you can do this in very many ways. I always like to come back to, it's not necessarily important the system that you use to individualize training. That's less important than knowing your system in and out and knowing the limitations and how to make modifications based on the observation you have. Lots of coaching is pattern recognition. If you get lots of reps in a similar system in which you know the limitations of and kind of the blind spots you have to keep an eye out for, that pattern recognition in a similar system, I think, is more advantageous than switching your system around all the time, because all of them are limited in their own respect. So I think that's really, really important to keep in mind. You absolutely can do things in a variety of ways. And I think probably even from like a coach's individualization perspective, some people would probably be better with one system versus the other, just the way that they think about training and the way they kind of have come up in their training history. So I think there's individualization from that perspective as well. There's not a right or wrong way to do it. It's just based on our assumptions that we're comfortable with, based on our kind of training history and the way that we view training, that kind of moderate approach seems to make the most sense to us, but that doesn't mean that it's the only way to do it, nor is it the only way that is, you know, quote unquote, defensible. I think you can do it a ton of different ways. There's just assumptions everywhere, and you just got to pick where you want to draw the line in the sand, understand the limitations of the way that you systematize the process, and that's going to get you where you want to go over time after you get more reps with more individuals and you get better pattern recognition. That's kind of the way that I view it.
Yeah, perfect. I just want to make sure you weren't kind of misunderstood. And I think that's so on the money. Like, it might have been a couple years ago now, but we were asked on a podcast, like, hey, what's the best way to quantify training volume? And we're like, kind of depends like how you program. And once you kind of make a decision of here are the things I'm going to track, you start to realize that they all kind of suck, but you know when they're useful. So like, we use a fatigue score with athletes that we work one-on-one with. And is that like validated in the research? No. Is it perfect? Far from it. But I can now look at it because I've had so much like experience with it and I've used it so consistently that I know when it's useful and I know when to disregard it, right? So I think that's just so key that if you were to throw a different metric in someone else's lap that they don't know, that they haven't had experience with using and it doesn't fit within their system and how they conceptualize training and their general approach to talking with athletes, all of these different factors, right? It's just not going to be useful. So I think that's a really, really good point. I have a few additional thoughts. I'm going to try to make these relatively succinct here. The first thing I'll say in direct response to Drew's question is that both of these kind of stagnant and ramping approaches are 100% viable, like no doubt about it. The next thing I'll say is that for me personally, based on, again, kind of the way I think about training, the way I like to communicate with athletes and just kind of what I've seen, I think that they're, like, on a week-to-week basis, I like to just think of psychological considerations, to be honest, right? And I think I've found a lot of benefit to that ramping approach for just building momentum and building excitement, even if it means, like, a lower starting point, okay? And that leads me to another, like, slight tangent, but I think still important to keep in mind, is that there's a difference between progressive overload and weekly progression, right? Going, like, the point of going from RP7 to RP8 to RP9 week to week is not for the purpose of progressive overload, at least in my opinion. I don't think we should think of progressive overload on that time scale. Instead, it's a weekly progression scheme largely for psychological considerations. That's personally my take on it. And then you need to think about, okay, within the training unit you choose to employ, you're going to have one of these approaches inherently built into it. So if you prefer to use a training block as your training unit, okay, does that training block generally have ramping approaches? Maybe it has ramping approaches half of the slots, but the other half of the slots are more of a constant approach. That's a feature of the training unit, and thus if you're pretty consistent with it, you can kind of compare week to week, and thus, like, that's why we can say, okay, we have a 12-week training cycle. We have a hypertrophy phase and a strength phase. Strength phase will have lower intercept fatigue and use these low fatigue strategies, right? Like, that, there's a considerable week-to-week, block-to-block difference, but that's built into the training unit, and thus you can actually compare unit to unit. Whereas if you choose to use the training week, you're kind of, I don't want to say forced, but your best bet is to probably keep it constant, right? So I think a lot of people get caught up there in that difference between weekly progression and progressive overload. Okay. The last point I will make, and again, this is kind of why my preference would be to go more towards the ramping approach. I actually think Zach might disagree with this, but we'll see, is that I think that the ramping approach may allow you to reach higher quote unquote peaks. So in other words, if you have a more constant approach, I've just found it's harder to kind of stick at that constant approach for multiple weeks and then hit a peak because you're kind of used to being constant, if that makes sense. And you might have accumulated a little bit more fatigue up to that point, as opposed to kind of that ramping approach. You maybe start a little bit lower, build some momentum, and you're kind of in the mindset of getting to that higher peak at the end. Am I married to that point I just made? Not necessarily, but I think there might be something to it. But Zach, let me know if you can poke holes in that.
No, I mean, honestly, I think it's just mostly semantics. I think the first time we discussed this, I wasn't totally understanding what you're saying. And so I guess the counter that I was going to have, but I hear what you're saying now, is that like in a very literal sense, if you just program, you know, a single out of 10 RPE, you can do that for multiple weeks. So it's like in perfect literal terms, I don't think it does that, because you can program whatever you want. But I think what you're saying is, from a tolerance perspective, what is an athlete more likely to tolerate? Probably a more ramped approach in which those very peak exposures are not handled as frequently. Now, counter argument, I'll say, is that if you really value that, you could assemble the entire, you know, programming approach around that to make it more consistent. And you could have the argument that the repeat about effect is going to kick in more readily if you're exposing yourself to those demands very frequently. Now, I think I align with you for the most part that I think the risk reward ratio there for most people is probably going to be favored to the ramping approach. And I just don't think you have to expose yourself to that, you know, very peak exposure all the time to get most of the benefits. I think there's diminishing returns of that. But yeah, from like a very literal sense, you could program whatever you want and do that every single week. And I don't think that's going to allow you to technically reach a higher peak. But if you're saying from like a tolerance perspective, not only psychologically, but physiologically as well, I think I agree with you. The only other thing I was going to plug in real quick before you wrap up, I do think that you made a really good point that I don't want to go understated. When you're kind of talking about a longer training unit, and people, you know, will often have the critique of like, well, I can't compare things on a week-to-week basis. I kind of have to wait till the end of the training cycle to make that evaluation. That's only a problem for the first one. Like that's, you know what I mean? Like when you kind of set out to do that, it's only a problem for the first one. And this also doubles down on the fact that why it is so important to pick a systematic approach that you're comfortable with and stick with those bounds for a long period of time. Because if you're keeping the organization of things relatively consistent, like I said, if you do that on an 8-week training cycle, let's say, and you have whatever approach of top sets that you keep, which is generally the set you're kind of keeping a finger on the pulse for performance, the second one that you do, you're going to have a direct comparison on a week-to-week basis that you can make from the past training cycle. So you're able to kind of see every single week how is performance trending in comparison to the last training cycle. Now, immediate counter, you're not the same person in that training cycle as you were the past training cycle, so there's a little bit of degree of fluctuation there. Hence why we kind of take that middle ground of not doing a 24-week training cycle and using that to kind of compare things along the way. That's where that kind of balance comes in. But I do think it's important to state that, yes, when you write down that first initial training cycle with quite a few variables changing, absolutely a limitation to be able to compare apples to apples week to week. But as soon as that first one's over, you're able to have a relatively solid week-to-week comparison from the last training cycle to evaluate performance on a little bit more of a shorter time scale, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I almost think having a system is more important than the system you choose to employ, right?
For sure.
If you choose a cycle-to-cycle approach and it doesn't go well the first cycle, I think you're actually better off sticking with that approach as opposed to saying, oh, the cycle-to-cycle approach doesn't work for me. Or on the other hand, maybe you take a repeated week approach and you say, this didn't work for me. I actually think it's better to just choose one, right? And to go with it. Now, I think on, you know, kind of the edges, you might be able to make some arguments, as we've obviously talked about in this podcast. But dude, like the training unit to training unit comparisons are just absolutely massive. If I know that we take your heaviest squat exposure in week 9 of the training cycle and you test at the end of whatever, week 11, week 12, whatever the case may be, we can compare that cycle to cycle. Like, I just, that training data is just so immensely valuable. And the fact that you are bought into, or not bought into, but you're committed to a certain system and you can actually get those patterns, that's when it's game over and you're really playing offense as opposed to always kind of playing catch up and trying to figure out what the heck is going on. So yeah, man, I would say last thing that I want to kind of circle back to in terms of ramping approaches, potentially allowing you to reach higher peaks, is that because the start of the next ramp is going to be a lower starting point, that might be another potential benefit. Now, of course, you can take a deload, you can take a less specific week, whatever the case may be. Like, that's not a binary thing there, but I just think practically there might be something there. But yeah, man, like this conversation gets me juiced up because it's stuff we've been talking about a lot recently as we, you know, kind of continue to poke holes in our current approach. And, you know, as we systematize that with our individualized programming group, how we can continue to make improvements on that. That's something we've been talking about a lot. So yeah, man, I think we can go ahead and wrap it up there unless you have anything to add.
Oh, thanks for everybody tuning in as always.
Yep. Thanks everyone for listening. Again, if you made it this far, and you can just go to iTunes or Spotify and leave a quick rating, that'd be much appreciated. And yeah, let us know what you think of the show. Let us know if you have any comments. You can hit us up through direct messages and chat about some of the stuff with us. It always gives us some idea fuel for things to talk about. And also, if you want to submit a question that we circle around to a few months from now, you can go ahead and click the link in the description to submit a question for us to potentially chat about on the show. All right, everyone, take care.